civil rights, even if you're poor and unkempt and maybe on drugs, you still have civil rights, and you better. Because if they roll back civil rights for people, you know, who can't fight back, then who's next? So what he was suggesting was that he would ask for a half reduction in the cast of characters I just read to you and the amount of personnel up there. And I just said, no way. He needs to hear from people right now. He needs to be pressured right now. That no, we don't want half our civil rights back. No, we don't want half the repressive class relocation program that he initiated. We want it all turned off now, and we want an investigation of how it happened in the first place. Scarce public resources should not be abused in this way, nor should human rights.
Now, is the Police Review Commission likely to pursue this, do you think?
I think he's going to try to pursue a halfway measure because politically he can turn to both sides of this issue and say, I accommodated you, and turn to the other side and say, I accommodated you. And my feeling is, no, you know,
yeah.
He can't call himself a radical or maybe he can call himself a liberal, but you never compromise with other people's civil rights.
Election time is coming. Unfortunately, so is my radio show time. I can't talk much longer. I know that you've written a song about this. Any chance of you doing a little a cappella singing over the phone?
I'd love to. It goes like this. This is called, it's not police repression, it's love. It goes, first they arrest you and throw you in jail. Tap all your phones and they jack up your bill. But they're so in love, they can't get you out of their minds. They're watching your house and they follow your car. They're tracking your movements wherever you are. Cause they're so in love, they can't get you out of their minds. Your name's in the paper about every day, and you're quoted as saying stuff you never say. And you're suddenly charged with a whole lot of crimes. Have to make court dates a whole lot of times. It's because they're in love. What else could it possibly be? It happens because they're in love with you, the way they're all in love with me.
Bravo!
Bravo!
Thank you, Chief.
And that was activist Carol Denny this morning talking to us from Berkeley, giving us all the latest on the Berkeley at Telegraph Avenue crackdown, plus, of course, her latest song, which will no doubt may show up on a new album when she comes out with one. Her last album was Failure to Disperse. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM on your FM dial. This is Bathrobes Pierre's Broadside, Civil Rights for the Poor, twice weekly show that happens 11 o'clock on Sundays and 6 o'clock on Thursdays. Normally, we invite your participation. In fact, we're still trying, actually. And we do have a calling number here at 423-5361. Earlier in the show, however, we found that our phone callers were being blasted away by the dulcet tones of radio station KSCO. So a programmer got on the air and called KSCO and demanded that they reduce their wattage. They apologized profusely but refused to do so. So we, of course, will have to file a complaint with the FCC. More of that later, and of course more from Berkeley, San Jose, and points north and south. We actually have stuff from San Diego too. We're going to run out of time though before we run out of material. We are privileged to have with us for the first time in the studios a man who has been closely following the case of police violence, perhaps police murder, in the shooting of Charles E. Vaughn Sr. in Seaside. This is a case I have referred to briefly. He was a man who was shot in May after being seen wielding a corkscrew on a roof, if I'm not mistaken. I see here a picture of a man shot to death by Seaside police. I'm looking at the Wednesday, May 20th story from the Monterey County Herald. A 60-year-old Seaside man believed to have been under treatment for mental problems. Notice how they quickly are rationalizing away any police violence in the first sentence of the story. Was fatally shot by police on an apartment roof Tuesday morning after he allegedly lunged at officers with a corkscrew. And we have here a man who has been not really following this intently. He has a thick, he got a thick sheaf of clippings here, Mike. We're talking to Mike Smith. Let me say without further ado, Mike is closely connected with the Peace and Freedom Party. In fact, weren't you a candidate?
Just on the County Central Committee.
You're one of the Central Committee people. Well, you got to watch out for these Central Committees. Where should we begin in this Charles E. Vaughn case? How did you first hear about it? Why are you concerned with it?
Well, first of all, Robert, I'd like to thank you for inviting me down to the studio to talk about this case, because it's so very important, because it's so widespread throughout not only our area, but throughout California and the United States. And the way we came to learn of this case was through a very good friend of ours, Mel Mason, who is an ex-city council member of Seaside. And he had come to a group of us that are taking up the Mumia Abu-Jamal case and informed us that his best friend, Charles Vaughn Sr., had been shot on May 19th of this year by the Seaside Police, and wanted to see what we could do in Santa Cruz County to assist Monterey County in keeping this issue alive. And I think it's extremely important for people to realize that...
What issue is that you're talking about?
Well, it's the abuse of police power. And in this particular case, if you only looked at the first page, as you read from, on May 20th, we would think there was a deranged person lunging at police with a corkscrew and had to be fatally shot. What we don't see in that page, but we learn in the later some 39 pages of press clippings and so forth, is that it was orchestrated by the police and by county or by mental health workers to a point that Mr. Vaughn was shot. And by that I mean that Mr. Vaughn was a 60-year-old man, grew up in Seaside, had his bachelor's, his MA, had been working on his PhD, was an educator, I believe, in high school, and at some years ago became mentally ill, suffered from schizophrenia, from delusions, from paranoia, etc. Because of being an extremely proud individual, he refused to take any medications, felt he could control the situation on his own, which friends, family, and so forth found he could not. He was living in a residence on Echo Avenue in Seaside that had belonged to another person who was on vacation, and family kept in constant contact with him. What led up to this particular incident and his killing was that mental health felt he was deteriorating mentally and needed to be hospitalized. Well, Mel Mason, this very good friend of his who had grown up with him, had asked both mental health and the police to be notified if there was any idea of hospitalization or they needed assistance with Charles in any way. He was not notified. Could have been at a few minutes' notice. Instead, mental health went to the police, had asked for their assistance in taking Mr. Vaughn to the hospital if it was needed. As we understand, the police asked if he was a danger to anyone or to himself, and originally mental health workers said he was not.
Gravely disabled, perhaps?
Probably, yes.
But that's the third condition that allows a 5150, an involuntary commitment.
No, I understand that, but the police, as we understand, refused to assist because he was not a danger to himself or others. In order to get police assistance, mental health then changed their tune and asked that police cooperate because he could possibly be combative. On the morning of the 19th of May of this year, police and mental health workers responded to Echo Avenue. Mr. Vaughn, as far as we know, simply was sitting in his residence calmly, was not creating a problem or a disturbance of any kind, and they had anticipated that an ambulance would be there to take him to the hospital. It was not. The police then left. The ambulance arrived. The police came back. And I'm sure we're irate because of being brought out and then leaving and then being sought to come back. Instead of simply acting in a support role to mental health workers to take Mr. Vaughn to the hospital, police then took over, literally shoved mental health workers out of the way, approached the residents. Now, if you can imagine approaching a mental health patient, mentally ill patient with schizophrenia, delusions, and paranoia, seeing three police officers armed in uniform approaching your residence, we would probably do what Mr. Vaughn did, and that was to bolt from the door, climb up on his one-story apartment roof, and simply sit there saying, "I don't want to go anywhere." Was not threatening anybody at that point, was not threatening to commit suicide, simply was sitting on the roof. As we're given to understand, one of the lead police officers climbed the roof, was attempting to talk him down and convince him at this point that they were his friends and only wanted to help him. Apparently the other two officers saw Mr. Vaughn stand up, and he apparently, at least according to the police, had a corkscrew in his hand.
Uh-huh, a lethal corkscrew.
A lethal corkscrew.
Except they were going to have a party with the cops.
Well, whatever his reason for having the corkscrew was, they immediately shot him to death.
How many shots?
I've heard between three, at the minimum of three, and the maximum I've heard on Bill Monning's program was five.
How far was he from the other officer we might have injured? Did he have a corkscrew? Was one found in his hand?
We're given to understand there was a corkscrew. I have no definite, solid information that there was.
How long was this corkscrew? Was it like a 6-foot corkscrew?
No, I think it was probably the regular 3 or 4 inch that we all use to open a bottle of wine. At that point, then, of course, they called in for paramedics, they called in for additional police support to handle crowd control and so forth. And the picture we see on the page of the Monterey County Herald on Wednesday, May 20th, shows paramedics taking the body of Mr. Vaughn off the roof. Now, they claim he was still alive and he died later at the hospital. We suspect very greatly that he was dead when they got to the roof. But the thing that's
why do you suspect that?
Well, because there has been no clear indication from anybody other than the press that he died later. There hasn't been a report from the hospital, to our knowledge, that he died at the hospital, so forth and so on.
Now, this is a month later, in fact, more than a month later. This is like 5 weeks later. Hasn't the hospital issued a report on his death? Hasn't an autopsy been done?
They're still waiting for the autopsy report.
Perhaps the autopsy person was drunk or incapacitated. What's the reason? Is this the usual wait time?
No, it isn't. And we've been unable to find out why it's taking so long. Now, I think what witnesses, and this is secondhand information from the son, Charles Vaughn Jr., but in talking to witnesses said that while they were trying to convince Mr. Vaughn to come off the roof and they were his friends, they also were shaking a mace can and in fact maced him, which caused him then to stand up and become irate with him, macing him in the face and so forth.
How strange. We also might add, Mr. Vaughn was an African-American man, correct?
That's correct. 60-year-old African-American, grew up in Seaside, a member of the community and so forth.
And what about the police officers? What color were they?
The lead police officer that we understand was on the roof was black, had grown up with Mr. Vaughn's son, and so knew something of the family. And that's another important point, is that the chief of police had grown up with Mr. Vaughn, with Mel Mason, knew the situation with the family, with Mr. Vaughn in the community and so forth. So it wasn't that Mr. Vaughn was suddenly recognized to be a mentally ill person and determined to be dangerous.
And similarly, because he was known, did he have a history of violence?
I guess there were verbal altercations. As far as physical altercations, there were none to my knowledge.
In
in Santa Cruz shootings that I've been interested in documenting, like the Happy John Dine shooting here in November and the Button Street shooting of Brian Andrus in March, a lot of what we came up with had to do with our either being at the scene of the shooting soon after it happened or interviewing eyewitnesses who were there. Have you spoken with any eyewitnesses who were at the scene or read any of their accounts?
I have not read any of their accounts. Only listened to one man speak at the candlelight vigil held a week ago last Friday at the shooting site, who was in his business across the street from the shooting, looked out and saw what had happened, and said that he went down immediately because he was so appalled when he found out that this was Mr. Vaughn, and who was known in the community around that area, and what had happened. And so I think the community, I know the community, at least a good share of it, is outraged, as is the family of Mr. Vaughn and our very important members of the community, including Mel Mason. Because what struck me as extremely important was we did not have a one-page article on this man being shot. Following that, we had almost 3 weeks of articles. And I have to say the Monterey Bay Herald, even though it seems to side with the police in some respects in their articles, does take into account that mental health training was offered to Seaside Police in the past and was rejected. It does take up a various number of issues concerning this case, and I think for, 38 or 39 pages of newspaper articles, you would never see that, certainly in the Sentinel. In fact, most of the information was blacked out of our press, to my knowledge.
Right. I think there was very small articles on it in the Sentinel. And, of course, even our own shootings, where Happy John Dine was shot dead, two shots from the pistol of Officer Connor Carey, allegedly for his, was it brandishing, was it pointing, was it reaching for, depends on which official account you want to believe, a toy gun. There wasn't that much media on it. There was Bob Gammon was then the reporter. He did more extensive coverage than anyone really has done since, and that wasn't much. And the main witnesses, the man who called it murder, the Tom Murphy witness, was essentially excluded from most accounts. And of course, the follow-up on all this, including the fact that the tape, which I played last show, the dispatch tape. Dispatch tape for the period of time around the Happy John Dine shooting has not been, was released in a censored form, and may, even the version we have may be censored. But the point I think that you're making is very well taken, that there was a great deal, relatively speaking, of media attention in the Monterey County Herald given to this subject that our Sentinel didn't give, and I've never seen actually given by any newspaper. Is that because the Monterey County Herald folks knew this guy? Is that because there's a particular sensitivity to Seaside Police violence? What do you think?
I think it's a multiple issue. In talking with one of the Monterey Bay Herald press people on the night of the candlelight vigil who interviewed me, she stated that it was the Monterey Bay Herald's own decision to run this series of articles, and it was not under a large community pressure. I can question that, but if that's true, I certainly applaud them for it.
Was there a lot of pressure, a lot of community pressure?
Oh, I think there has been. I think Mel Mason, and if you look at the number of groups that have come to this cause, certainly in Monterey County, I'd like to read just a few of the organizations that are currently involved in this process of going through and examining what did occur and what is occurring in Monterey County with their police department. We have a coalition of minority organizations. We have the NAACP, the Alliance for Mentally Ill, National Lawyers Guild, WILPF, LULAC, ACLU, Regional Alliance for Progressive Policies, or RAP, now the California Peace and Freedom Party at our state meeting recently took up this issue as a resolution and will be following through and informing members of what is transpiring with this. Lance McClair, former mayor of Seaside, Bill Monning, who we all know as having run for Congress and other legislative positions, who is an attorney and a well-respected member of the Monterey Bay area. Mel Mason, as I mentioned, who's a Seaside City Council member, also involved, and which I was not aware of, is a group called the Protection and Advocacy Incorporated.
I heard about that, and I read about that in the paper, that here in Santa Cruz, we have struggled to get an independent investigation of the Dine shooting and the Button shooting, and the Police Review Board has refused to hold public hearings, refused to have an independent investigation, refused to do an early investigation. We thought maybe the grand jury, maybe getting somebody from out of town with a district attorney's office or the state attorney general's office. We thought of even an independent tribunal completely privately formed that we would try to, you know, investigate the facts. But here we have an organization, Protection and Advocacy Incorporated, which apparently has some kind of national backing, national resources and funding, and a real interest. And we actually thought not only could this organization look into the Vaughn shooting, but Happy John Dine was developmentally disabled as well. It might be an avenue for us to further investigate a case that the local authorities refused to investigate. But getting back to the Vaughn case, what is Protection and Advocacy, and how have they offered to intervene? What's that about?
What they are is, I believe, a national organization, but certainly in California, they advocate for the rights of the mentally ill and do investigate these kinds of cases on an independent basis to see if it was legitimate to use lethal force in this case, or if circumstances leading up to that were actually caused by the police and by mental health workers, which we believe happened. We're given to believe by the Seaside Chief of Police that officers have to spontaneously make decisions and cannot do a game plan, as he states. They had nothing but time to prepare a, quote, game plan.
Well, you never can tell how many people he might have damaged with that corkscrew up there on the roof.
Well, he may never have even had to go to the roof if they hadn't approached his residence at that particular time.
Think of the people terrorized in the streets with this man sitting up there with a corkscrew. I mean, something had to be done.
Well, you know, certainly something was done, and unfortunately, we'll never now know if Mr. Vaughn could have been helped and hospitalized as they had predicted they wanted to do.
Does patient advocacy have a record of looking at such cases in other cities? Are you familiar with anything they've done?
No, I have only become familiar recently with this particular group, but the attorney that was at a community meeting last night, which I'd like to expand on a little bit in Seaside, said they're very, very involved in this particular case, as with other cases around California and certainly possibly other areas of the nation, and I understand they're a very influential group. They're both privately and governmentally funded, but we understand that they keep all of their information private. They do not give out information until they come out with a final report, and so we're looking forward to their participation. Now, what I'd like to do, basically, is describe what's going on not only in Seaside with this particular incident, but also in Santa Cruz. In Seaside, so far, they have had the meeting of the City Council, or one of the City Council meetings. I was privileged to go to and present a packet from our mayor, Celia Scott. I had given her a packet of all, and the other city council members here, of all the press releases on this particular incident in Seaside, and a cover letter asking for their support with our police department in updating training regarding mental health cases and so forth. The response I got from Celia Scott was very encouraging, because she had contacted Police Chief Belcher, and I got a packet of information from him that in, I believe it's November and December of this year, they are having police training regarding developmentally disabled individuals that will be taking place at the San Andreas Regional Center. They're having much more difficulty with the Seaside Police and with the City Council there. They're not as open, apparently, as they even are here in Santa Cruz County, and we believe they're, you know, not the best, certainly. But this issue is going to be continuing in Seaside. It's not going away, as I think they hope it will, by just time going by and people becoming disinterested and the press certainly getting out of reporting on it and so forth. But the meeting last night was a community meeting, had probably 35 to 40 people there from many of the organizations that I mentioned, but also had Fred Keeley from the Assembly there, and they approached him on what kinds of legislation he could bring about within the Assembly to upgrade the training of police in dealing with mental health cases, and also if funds were available through our state to fund these kinds of training programs. The other thing I find very interesting in going to every meeting so far down there is this is not a hate the police. There is only a search for justice, and certainly bringing the two police or three police involved to justice for the killing of Charles Vaughn, but it's also bringing about training of our police departments and our police officers so that they can adequately deal with situations such as the John Dine case, such as the Charles Vaughn case. And so we are certainly encouraging in Santa Cruz County. I've written a cover letter and provided all of the press releases to not only our city council members, but also to our board of supervisors, to Sam Farr, our congressional representative, to Fred Keeley, and to Bruce McPherson, and basically asking that they draft legislation and pass it to deal with the upgrading of training for police and dealing with mental health cases, as well as other similar types of cases. And I'm not naive to think that just drafting and passing legislation is going to solve the problem. The police departments have a tremendous amount of mandated training that will take place or does take place and sometimes doesn't take place. And I think more importantly, it's an oversight group and has to come from the community level, pressuring our city council, pressuring our boards of supervisors and our legislators to see that mandated training does take place and that there are penalties imposed upon police departments, on law enforcement agencies, and on individuals when they fail to bring this about and or refuse to engage in it.
Now, let's get back to the officers who did the actual shooting. Because I think, while it's all very well for, you know, Keeley to do some posturing and politicians to say, oh, let's give more money to mental health training of police officers, this doesn't go to the issue of immediate dealing with the question of whether there's been real rampant police abuse here, whether the officers, in essence, engaged in a homicide or, let's say, manslaughter. And, of course, I doubt, has the DA come up with any kind of report on this yet?
What's very interesting in this case is they have not, after all of this time, made a decision, and yet all three police have been placed back on full duty. And this is extremely unusual.
Now, I know that the names of these officers were withheld from the public for several days after the shooting. Who were the shooters?
Actually, in probably within the first week, the press did get names of the police officers that were actually involved in the shooting. We're going through actual packet here, which is considerable.
I'm looking it over now.
I think that it's probably within the first few days.
Here's a recap of the shooting. Look at this.
Looks like police officers Joseph Bertina and Ronald Guth were the shooters. And of course the question is, what's the history of these men? And we learn here from an article that this tragedy is a repetition of the circumstances of the death of Fidelio Pascua. And Fidelio Pascua, apparently it was an incident that happened in 1992. Are you familiar with this?
Very slightly, but as I'm given to understand, he was another mental health case that was in his residence. They actually went into the residence and I believe shot him to death in the bathroom. He was had locked himself into the bathroom. They broke the door down and ended up shooting him to death.
He was threatening them with a toothbrush covered with fluoride toothpaste, perhaps?
Actually, I don't know the particular circumstances of that individual case, but there have been many, many complaints about the Seaside Police and not only responding to situations where they were needed and not responding, but responding inappropriately. The two police officers that we believe actually did the shooting were white. As I mentioned, the lead police officer, Sergeant Lumpkin, was black.
At least they didn't hit the police officer who was black. They got the other black guy. Well, I don't want to sound cynical and make it necessarily appear as some sort of racial thing, although it's interesting, the guy on the roof facing the lethal corkscrew was a black guy, and the guys on the ground doing the shooting were the white guys. You know, again, it's not really relevant. What's relevant, of course, is the history of these police officers and the specific circumstances around this particular shooting. As I guess you've already mentioned, the police, it's kind of a sympathetic account by the Monterey County Herald, although it is so extensive and so regular a coverage of a shooting I have never seen in the papers, I guess short of the Kennedy assassination or something, you know, where there is a big political leader who gets shot. Do we know anything about the record of these two officers? What was it? Goth, and then the other fellow, Bertina?
I wouldn't have any specific knowledge because we haven't been privy to that in the past, and they may down in Seaside. I haven't gotten any to this point of their past history.
You know, it's interesting. If somebody else had done this, that person's past would be all over the media, completely all over the media. You would be hearing about they were rude to a child 7 years ago if a guy was shot in this fashion. Particularly a well-respected elderly man who essentially was no real danger, apparently. And that's, of course, what the vast scandal here is. But here in this situation, of course, they conceal who the officers were. Now they conceal their background and history. And one can't but wonder, what are they trying to hide? If these guys have a clear record, then they should say their record is clean. If they have five complaints, they should say there are five complaints about these guys in the past. It's also interesting that around the same time this was happening, as I mentioned before, we finally here in Santa Cruz got the police chief to release what he now claims is the uncensored radio dispatch tape of the Happy John Dine shooting. We had thought, and he initially stated he would not release that it should never have been released. He didn't state what the specific claim he had for confidentiality was. We assumed it would be some perverted twist on the idea of the confidential police files, which apparently swallow up everything and the kitchen sink as well. But interestingly enough, Police Chief Steve Belcher here in Santa Cruz did release that. And frankly, I think that we can, to some extent, thank you and the other citizens and other interested community members in Seaside who have been pushing this issue so intensely and with such political effectiveness. And of course, now your problem is going to be, I mean, that you got Belcher to release this tape for us. I don't think he wanted us to start going to the courts shouting, what are you hiding, what are you hiding? And indeed, I still think they're hiding something. The tape sounds to me, it still sounds doctored to me. You know, there's clicks and strange sounds on it that may well be appropriate, but again, we haven't taken it to an expert. It's hard to tell. We played that tape as a This is the tape of the shooting of Happy John Dine last November, the police radio dispatch tape of communications to and from police officers to the central radio dispatch. But getting back to Seaside, it seems to me the danger now is you have politicians entering and, you know, calls for money and so forth, that once they can't ignore you, and once they can't dismiss you, and once they can't discredit you, those are the first three avenues, then they try to co-opt you. That's my fear, is what's happening there. What do you think about that concern of mine?
I don't share that concern at this point, because I think, for the most part, the people that are keeping this alive are aware of that possibility and will be looking out for that possibility. And I believe that if that starts to occur with our legislators or anyone else, it will certainly make good press coverage. And so I think we can only expect that our legislators will do what we are requesting. If they go beyond that, then they'll have to be taken to task. I suspect the other legislators will probably not take any action before around August. I think there's a July hiatus pretty much taking place, in which vacations take place for legislators as well as everyone else. So I expect around August to start seeing the other legislators come into the picture. And I'm hoping, in fact, I've requested in the letter and packets I've sent to Sam Farr and McPherson and so forth, that any hearings take place or any meetings with the legislators take place down the Seaside area, and that people from this area in Santa Cruz go down there to the site of where this occurred.
Yeah, but isn't the basic issue kind of being ignored here and sort of shifted over? I mean, the question about money for retraining the police for developmentally disabled, I'm reading about the Seaside Police getting big bucks now for new squad cars and new police officers. This is in the Monterey Herald. I don't know how big a bucks. It's not really fair for me to say one way or the other. I just noticed a few stories. The real issue is, was this shooting appropriate, and what forum is going to review that evidence? Are there public hearings scheduled?
To my knowledge, public hearings aren't scheduled, but the family of Charles Vaughn Sr. have, to my knowledge, and I believe it was in the Monterey County Herald on May 27th, that they have gotten the services of an attorney from Oakland, and to my knowledge, it was the same attorney that handled the Rodney King investigation, private investigation. So I think that along with all of the community organizations, with state organizations, with representation by this attorney and so forth, this isn't going away, and an independent investigation will take place. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I think it's going to have great impact.
Right. I'm wondering about the format, because even though you guys are continuing to pressure, I think, you know, what they're doing now is they're handling it. This is the damage control approach. And maybe even there are genuine concerns and an opportunity for disabled and mentally ill training to take place. We have an incoming phone call. We're going to actually try to see if this is going to work on our phone lines. I'm afraid KSCO is probably still having a fun time with our lines, but let's see what we can do here. Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz, we hope.
Hi, Robert. This is Roxanne.
Unfortunately, we have a deadline. We have a deadline, and we just cut off our caller. Boy, sorry about that. Roxanne, if you are near radio, I think you're not. Roxanne Acistapache has been following the Beach Flats controversy, the sellout of the Seaside Corporation, to the Seaside Corporation of the Beach Flats, compliments of our once liberal Santa Cruz City Council. And that is an issue we've been following in show after show. I want to make a few brief announcements here, lest I forget, in the midst of this very interesting dialogue I'm having with Peace and Freedom Party Central Committee person and police violence opponent, I guess we'd call you, Mike Smith. Tonight at 7 o'clock, the Alliance for Democracy is going to have a special meeting with the Beach Flats Working Group, and I may have these names slightly wrong, so don't quote me on the exact names. They're going to be meeting at, I think it's 500 Chestnut. It's the corner of Chestnut and Walnut Streets, where there's going to be discussions of what to do in the next saga of the fight to keep the Beach Flats in the hands of the people who are still living there, and to keep the Beach Flats property and the options there in the hands of the residents of Santa Cruz instead of in the pocket of Charles Canfield. That's 7 o'clock tonight. There's also a meeting at 3 o'clock, or is it 3:30? I'm not sure. Better show up early to be sure, at the public library on the second floor of the library, which I was told about by Green Party activist David Silva, and I'm struggling to remember what that meeting was. He announced it in a
task force. The meeting I think you referred to is a task force on hate crimes that has been organized with the Sheriff's Department hosting it and has been meeting for some time with representation from NAACP and various and sundry other groups. I just have become interested and plan to go to that particular... Well, I thought it was at 2 o'clock, but as you say, it may well be 3 or 3:30, so...
I had heard it was 3 or 3:30, but maybe it's a 2. So the best thing to do is to get a couple of good books and stock the library looking for the meeting of the Hate Crimes Task Force. It's important for a number of reasons, because I believe David Silva said he was successful in getting the sheriff, Mark Tracy, to add to the list of groups the homeless as one of the groups that against which there'll be protection from hate crimes, which of course, since the sheriff's deputies are involved in some of the most outstanding hate crimes, that should be an interesting process to see how the sheriff prosecutes his own officers. I won't be holding my breath for that one, but it's good to see that it's being mentioned, at least, as a sort of a basis, as something that has to be done. I also want to remind everybody out there, as I have throughout the show, that tomorrow night is Don't Sleep Tonight night. That's the night where if you're in your house, if you're even if you're all comfy and warm and watching a nice TV show, don't go to sleep. Stay up and remain in solidarity with the homeless, and give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and tell us that you're staying up so we can log how many people stay up that night in solidarity with the homeless. We have people in San Diego, people in Portland, people in Seattle, even someone in Minneapolis, someone in New York is staying up. And actually 200 people at the San Diego concourse planned not only to stay awake, but to risk arrest by serving coffee inside the concourse of the San Diego plaza down there, the city center, where they've been camped for 3 months in search of shelter in San Diego. They've been signed up on the outside. Now, in honor of the Santa Cruz homeless, they're going to move to the inside. And if you want to send... not only call 423-HUFF, my HUFF line, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, to tell us that you're staying awake, but also call the City Council 24-hour message line and let them know you want a real change immediately in the Santa Cruz City sleeping ban. And that number is 429-3550, 429-3550. Get your pencils now. The two numbers, 429-3550 for the City Council to leave them a message. You can do that even now if you won't be in town on Monday, or you're going to be, say, awake in some other city perhaps, because you don't have to be in Santa Cruz to stay awake. And you can also call my number, 423-HUFF, to let us know that you are in solidarity with us. If you can't stay awake because you have a job to go to, and imagine how homeless people feel when they're in a situation, throw off your blankets, because the homeless not only aren't allowed to sleep at night, they're not allowed to cover up in the city of Santa Cruz with blankets or protective covering. Does that sound crazy? Does that sound cruel? Well, unfortunately, it is the real truth here in Santa Cruz. And so if you can't make the business of not sleeping, then throw off your blankets and feel what it's like to be there all night without a blanket. Of course, you'll get bitten by the mosquitoes, and you're probably something you'd do anyway because it's the summer. But hey, maybe it'll be a cold night and you'll get a taste of it. There was also a caller who called in asking that we replay the John Dine radio dispatch tape. And we don't have time to do that today, and in fact, we probably won't do it because we've already done it. We did it on the air last time. What we may do is an expanded show once we get some information about how valid that tape is. And we need to talk to experts who actually know what a real radio dispatch tape would sound like, because there seem to be gaps in the tape. But it could be that that's how a radio dispatch tape happens, that it doesn't happen in real time, that it stops and then starts again. So we don't know for sure. However, if you are really interested in hearing that tape, I'm considering a public playing of that tape. If enough people are interested, give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and leave your phone number or a contact number where you can be reached, and we will try to have a time when we can play that tape so you can listen to it. It's not terribly instructive, but I want you to be able to hear it as our radio audience heard last Thursday. Actually, I was away. You heard a taped version of it, but hopefully you did hear it. I also want to announce that homeless activist and sometime lunatic Chris Brozda, who is actually a very fine writer and a man who has a lot to commend him when he's not growling and grumbling. He has his problems, as many of us do. We all have our problems. He is now in jail facing charges of parole violation and, I don't know, fighting words. And normally I would view this with a somewhat skeptical eye, because Chris can become very outspoken and even physically threatening very quickly. But I haven't seen that happening recently, and I got the complete account of what happened recently from his father, Joe Brozda, who's a doctor, and who actually was playing chess next door in the coffee roasting company downtown when Chris was arrested. Chris was arrested for falling asleep after buying a cup of coffee in the next door candy store. I think it's Marina's or Marino's Candy. It's a large candy store which is adjacent to the coffee roasting company downtown. There are a couple stores down. They have an outdoor patio. So apparently somebody called the police on him because they didn't like the way he looked, or he was snoring too loud, or who knows. And the police came and started treating him in an abusive fashion. He said something to the effect, apparently,